Hello and thanks for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you'd like to hear more Conversations interviews, they're all there on our website, abc.net.au/conversations. Or, of course, you can just go direct to iTunes and subscribe to the Conversations podcast. No cost, no ads, it's free.
How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that was the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day,
I'll never accept
it. It was like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Richard Hill is an academic and a writer, and he says that right now, universities are not a happy place to be. Not if you're an academic. You might have a picture in your head of these people as well-paid daydreamers with tenure, as tweedy professors who chat with their colleagues and students aimlessly about truth, philosophy, the nature of things. But Richard says a more reliable picture would be of an overworked drudge who's trying to teach and think in between complying with excessive bureaucratic reporting. He says that unis have changed, and quite radically. They've devolved from these freewheeling centres of debate and research and dissent into something like a shopping mall of education throughputs. Students are now treated like shoppers who have come to expect that they will get the degree that they pay for. The upshot of all this are universities with huge marketing departments and shrinking standards. He's written a book, it's got the catchy title of Wackademia, an insider's account of the troubled university. Hello, Richard.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, sir. You're quoting a professor, an unnamed professor of political science, who says, "There has to be something better than what we've got. I honestly would not encourage my PhD students to work in a university. It would be a dereliction of duty on my part."
Mm.
How widespread is this sentiment?
I was stunned when I first heard this. I actually emailed him back and phoned him and said, you know, just to check this out to make sure it was all true. And he said, yes, I absolutely believe what I'm saying. And such was his disenchantment, if you like, with the university system. And in fact, he's the same respondent who referred to universities as Pythonville.
Pythonville?
Pythonville.
As in like the snake itself, or as in Monty Python?
As in the Monty Python.
There'll be a lot of people hearing this and they'll be saying to themselves, well, you know, academics have got it pretty good. They're a privileged lot. What have they got to complain about? Mm. When you hear that, well, what do you say to that?
Well, there's a number of things, really. You know, one of the things about academics, they're rarely mentioned in the public sphere. You know, what we hear a lot about are, you know, how excellent universities are, about how, you know, tens of thousands more students are coming into the system. But rarely do we hear about academic discontent. Now, academic discontent is alive and well. Not only are they worried about what they regard as the lack of attention to what they consider to be core activities like research and teaching, but the very real sense that universities have lost what they consider to be the central purpose of a university, which is critique, debate, and the creation of public intellectual work. So overwhelmed with work are academics these days that often they haven't got time to actually do most of these very, as they see them, very core activities.
You use the phrase student shoppers.
Yes.
And that the unis are very much and almost completely geared towards the student shopper. Is that your phrase? And what does that mean?
No, it's not my phrase, actually. And it's a phrase coined by an English academic, Laurie Taylor. Yeah, I actually prefer the term shopper than consumer, because consumer sort of gives an air of kind of autonomy and choice. And really, a lot of students are shoppers. You know, one of the things that we do know from the data that is available out there is something derived from a first-year university survey. And it's taken most years. And what it attempts to do is to highlight the nature of students' experiences at university following their first year. And a number of points come out of that. And there are two principal ones which I want to highlight. And the first one is that over a half regularly say they can't identify with their institutions. And a third actually say that they've never really made a friend at university.
They've never made a friend at uni?
Yeah, a third say they've never really managed to make a friend at university, which is extremely worrying, you know, for those people in terms of their experience at university. Now, if we're attempting to explain that, there are a number of factors we need to look at. Not least is that a lot of students actually do their university education now online from home on their personal computers. But even those students who actually go onto campuses, and here I'm aware of my own son, and he actually said it really was like a bit of a drive-through. He used to go to his lectures, take notes, you know, hopefully hang around for somebody to talk to, which there rarely was, because very often the students used to go straight home.
So there's this model now, and I think you've got a quote there from Lindsay Tanner, former finance minister, who's now at a major university, who says that universities are knowledge department stores. Yes. So what's wrong with this model, yeah, student shopper consumer model?
Well, I guess there's a number of problems with it. One is it's a very instrumental approach to education, isn't it? And it's designed essentially to get students trained up into certain vocations. They prepare students along career paths. You know, they're encouraged to have portfolios that they can present to their employers so they can demonstrate what are called graduate attributes. So they become what is known in the university system as job-ready graduates. Now, that's fine insofar as a lot of students do want to go into jobs. They do want careers, you know. But if that becomes an end in itself to the exclusion of a whole range of other experiences, then that becomes quite concerning. For example, if you read accounts, for example, people who are in the university system in the 60s and the 70s, and here I'm thinking of Mungo McCallum and his wonderful reflections of his time at the University of Sydney. And he talks very eloquently and movingly, actually, about not only going to wonderful lectures and tutorials and being involved in this sort of, you know, the energy of education, but actually also spending enormous amount of time with other students in bars, in cafes, and having time and space to do that. Now, the problem with a lot of university students these days, and if you ask most of them, they'll tell you this, is they're often in a hurry and a rush. And the rush is because they're often on the way to work. Their mothers who have to go home or, you know, undertake certain domestic duties, whatever it might be, constantly seeking to balance home, work and education. So it's a very onerous challenge for many students and not a very enjoyable experience by all accounts.
Yeah, there seems to be less of a view that there's value in doing things that don't necessarily have a job at the end of it. And my own university experience was I studied all kinds of things that didn't prepare me for anything except maybe immediately to become an academic, and I wasn't good enough to do that, whether it was English literature or philosophy or fine art, a whole lot of things like that. But over the years have been enormous value to me, and they take a long while to pay off. It's easy to scoff at that kind of coursework these days in the world we live in now.
It is. And look, I was stunned not so long ago to read in the Australian Higher Education Supplement about Professor Stephen Schwartz, who's the Vice-Chancellor, or was the Vice-Chancellor of Macquarie University. And he's actually one of the more outspoken Vice-Chancellors about some of the deficiencies of the university system. And what he actually decided to do after reflecting on the process of university education was to actually put on a course in the third year to teach something called practical wisdom. Global affairs, about war, about conflict, about relationships, about things like love and beauty. And he was quite right, and I thoroughly agreed with him that these things are really important as part of our education. You know, it's not only simply doing rote learning and making sure you complete your assessment and attending lectures and being job ready at the end of the program. The real point is to have this holistic, you know, experimental part of your life where you can actually engage with others casually and formally and otherwise in a whole host of different sorts of relationships and encounters. But the question arises, of course, the obvious question. If we aren't teaching these things until the third year of a course, what on earth are we teaching at universities? You know, if we're wanting to have graduates who can lead decent relationships, can communicate effectively with people, can treat their partners and their pets well, can live in neighbourhoods and communities and think more expansively about what it means to be a global citizen, the question arises, are universities necessarily preparing our graduates for doing this? And my contention is, I don't think so.
Richard, you write in your book about the rise of managers within universities. And how are managers impinging on the work of academics?
Well, look, academics are regulated in a whole host of ways. As in most other jobs, you have periods of probation where, you know, you're meant to prove yourself and prove your worth and make sure you can actually do the job, you know. The problem with probation that I've learnt recently is I have a colleague, and I won't say where she works, but I was stunned, actually, to hear that she's been on probation for 9 years, you know. And this is about the same length as people get, you know, for sort of mugging somebody on the street. And And I said, how come? She said, well, I've been at three different universities, and every university I go to, I have to have another period of probation. So here she is in actually quite a senior academic position now, still having to complete this period of probation. And in her first period of probation, it was a five-year stint, you know, which in itself would suggest an enormous amount of oversight and regulation on the part of her line managers. Now, there are various kind of mechanisms which are in place to kind of make sure you comply. And the main one, of course, is the annual performance review. And this is where you actually state your goals and actually review what you've done last year and make sure you've actually met all these goals. You know, it's a process that can be subverted very easily, but it's a process which is not objective. Now, why isn't it objective? Well, one of it's to do with personal idiosyncrasies. Now, if you don't actually get on with your line manager, your performance review, as anybody who's been in this situation knows, can take on a particular flavour. If you get on with your line manager, you can get a very positive review and you can get pushed forward for promotion and encouraged into all sorts of activities. So these are not objective indicators.
How do we get here then? This begins with the Dawkins Review of universities, doesn't it, in the 1980s?
I think we have to go one step back, actually, and look at some of the ideological sort of context within which these reforms were being developed. And certainly I went back to an essay that was written by Milton Friedman, who was one of the ideological inspirations for Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And this was an essay written in 1955 about the role of universities in relation to the economy and society more generally. And the argument essentially was that, you know, there should be a system of student loans and that universities should be deregulated. They should be out there in the open competitive market competing against each other for business. And what we've seen in the post-Dawkins era is the development of a business model. And what that has meant for academics is the development of a relationship between students and themselves, not as, you know, educator and student, but more or less as facilitator of an educational process in which the student becomes a shopper and a consumer.
I can see all kinds of good things coming out of this idea of competition. I mean, can't you? I mean, rather than all universities offering the same courses, you'd have greater specialisation, in theory, from this process. Mm. They'd try harder. They'd be more careful about the hiring of academics. Universities would simply then try harder to deliver a better quality education. Has it worked out that way, though?
Well, yes and no. You know, there are obviously some courses which have emerged as being very interesting. Others have fallen away. And there are some examples of quite bizarre courses that have emerged.
Like what?
Oh, you know, I suppose casino studies, surfing studies. You know, you can do courses.
Sorry, casino studies?
Casino studies.
There's a course in casino studies?
Yes, there certainly is. And I think at more than one university. You can find courses in the UK and America, some bizarre ones, actually. David Beckham studies. You can do a course on Judge Judy. You can do, there's a course on the phallus. There's a course on the cyber porn, you know, all manner of courses. And part of these are attempts, if you like, to sex up education courses so they can actually be sold to student consumers.
How has the language of the business school crept into the rest of the university?
Well, we've seen the emergence of all sorts of, you know, rhetoric that, you know, we see floating around the university sector, and usually find them in mission statements and vision statements and so forth. And you get obviously throughputs, outputs, inputs, and now, you know,
key performance indicators, stakeholders.
Yeah, that's it. The bean counters are attempting now to assess the impact of what we actually do as academics. The other kind of mantras which are regularly trotted out by PR departments in universities are, you know, these words, these endless words, which, you know, sound very attractive, and you see them everywhere in job advertisements, in logos and mottos and slogans, things like excellence, opportunity, flexibility is a primary
innovation.
One.
Innovation.
Innovation, and all these which are regularly trotted out.
Continual improvement. I'm quoting from La Trobe University's vision statement, which you've got in your book here. This is their vision statement. La Trobe University will continue to enhance its profile nationally and internationally and will achieve wide recognition for delivering socially responsible, inclusive, relevant, and radical learning, teaching, and research. It's a bit of a hooray for everything statement, isn't it?
It doesn't
really mean anything to
well,
me.
Well, yeah, anybody's read Dodd Watson's weasel words know that often these words actually don't reflect what they're intended to mean, you know.
The word enhance is always the tip-off, I think. As soon as you hear the word enhance, what follows is likely to be a bit spurious, I think, isn't it?
That's right. And I was actually very intrigued by the use of that word radical, actually. I thought it kind of stuck out like a sore thumb, you know, because it didn't seem to belong in the new corporate sort of language that exists around universities.
It seems to me that when you hear read statements like that, it's a bit like the act of Kevin Rudd speaking Mandarin. It's not what he's saying in Mandarin. It's the fact that he's speaking Mandarin. And it seems to me these are messages from the universities, because they all have these vision statements that are like this. And the message is implicit. It seems to be, we speak this language. We can dress up what we do in this language, because we know you can't see anything has... you won't be able to see that it has value unless we dress it up in this language.
In the first draft of the book, actually, I was going to write something about universities being rather like sort of really poor amateur theatres. You know, what goes on behind the scenes very often is extremely chaotic, extremely disorganised, and this notion of excellence. Let me give you one small example where the reality doesn't seem to match these kind of bold claims. One of which is that universities actually hire people to do a job, and when you rock up at a new university, you're given teaching, and it's often referred to as the bread and butter activity of academic life. And you can be given units which you know nothing about. This could be, you know, a month or a few weeks before the semester actually starts. And what you're expected to do is not only kind of gen up on the literature, you know, on the study guide, and learn everything about the unit and what it means, you know, and focus on the assessment. You're meant to appear as this expert.
In 2 weeks you've got to become an expert in something?
It absolutely happens. Now, look, let me tell you this, that there are something in the order of 67,000 casual employees at our universities. If you ask many of those about their experience of teaching in universities, and bear in mind they teach up to 80% of units in the first year of some universities, and 50% actually almost across the board, casual employees teaching this stuff. And very often they're employed at the last minute. They're given units that they have no familiarity with, no knowledge in. They have to go through this stuff at raider nuts, try and internalize all the knowledge, and then they have to actually try and teach this stuff. And somebody actually said not so long ago, a casual said to me that she was one page ahead of the students, constantly one page ahead, you know, trying to keep abreast of them and hoping that you haven't got a student who's really fully knowledgeable about the unit.
I can't tell you how distressing that is, because you have that expectation when you go to a university to do a course, that your teacher is someone with deep familiarity with the subject, who's thought about it, has imbibed it, has seen it from several different sides, and can impart not just the textbook understanding of it, but the wisdom of it as well.
Absolutely. Let me just say, Richard, that the vast majority of academics will teach in the way you've just described. And my intention is not to denigrate them or denigrate the academic community. What I am saying is, in the context of a system where you have these huge expanding numbers, and now we're in the area of having students of probably about a million plus students in the system, as opposed to the 500,000 or so we had in around 1990, that we've got huge class sizes, we've got academics who are under the cosh in terms of doing numerous sorts of activities. And very often when the, you know, casuals are given teaching responsibilities, they are in areas that they're not thoroughly familiar with. Now, this is not to say that they don't do a good job in the end, because I think they work extremely hard to deliver a good teaching outcome for their students. But these things do occur.
What you seem to be saying, if you're taking like the long view on this, is that sometime around the 1980s, a decision was made to greatly increase the numbers in tertiary education, and they were hugely increased, vastly so. But taxpayers or governments weren't really prepared to fund that huge increase. The universities had to go find funds elsewhere, from overseas students, from all sorts of places. And in this process, it's kind of corrupted really what was the core point of the university.
Yes, I think so. And I think that universities have been deliberately underfunded.
Deliberately? Why?
Deliberately. Well, because the prevailing ideology is one which says that the university education should be subject to the same market forces as any other enterprise. The problem is, in adopting the business model, is that you have this situation in which universities often appear to be like corporations, like large private companies, you know. And yet they're not. They're partly funded by the public purse, and they're encouraged to generate funds through other sources. And of course, they're extremely reliant on overseas students. The problem with this, of course, is that they often mimic private companies, you know. So it's no surprise, for example, as is common now across a lot of Australian industries, you have vast numbers of casual staff, often who haven't got any entitlement to holiday pay or sick leave, who are often, you know, subject to hire and fire policies, have no right of appeal when they actually lose their jobs, And on the other end of the scale, you have vice chancellors whose salaries have ballooned out to, in many cases, over $1 million a year.
Because they're CEOs now, aren't they?
They become more like CEOs. So what you have is this kind of mimicking of the private company world, but in a sense, they're not. You know, they're still funded by the public purse and expected to function as if they are public institutions. A lot of colleagues of mine asked me, for example, about how do I feel about the private universities? And I said, well, I think they're more honest in that they are out to make a profit. They're very clear about what their aims are. You go on their websites and they are private institutions dedicated to making profit. And you can actually go along with that to a certain degree, you know, and actually they do rather well, some of these private universities. But it's the public sector, which I really think suffers from a bit of an identity crisis.
I'm with Richard Hill. He's the author of Wackademia, an insider's account of the troubled university. What kind of pressure is being brought to bear on academics to avoid failing students?
I think it's very subtle and it's done in a whole variety of different ways. My experience has been, my last university certainly, that we had something called the Board of Assessors. This was a meeting that took place at the end of every semester. And the aim of it was to reflect on, adjudicate upon the distribution of results. And what used to happen was that we used to receive various diagrams, histograms and pie charts from the teaching and learning people. And if there was a significant number of fails in your unit, you were invited to actually please explain why this was the case. Now, the nature of the discussion that actually took place wasn't so much that, what is the nature of the student body? You know, has it changed from last year? It was a sense of that you as an academic had to explain what has gone wrong in terms of why so many students are actually failing. The responsibility for this failure rate was placed upon us.
And what's the pressure that's on that Board of Assessors then? Is that coming from a student population that's in effect saying, I pay good money for this degree and you're failing me?
Well, it's partly that, yes. There are certain expectations, but it's also the attrition rate. You know, the attrition rate in some universities is fairly significant. The last one I was at, it was in the order of 30%+. In other words, those students who actually came to university but didn't complete for a whole variety of reasons. And it meant, in effect, that university sought to do was to retain those students come what may. So when students failed, you were discouraged from failing. And the emphasis was in trying to retain those students. And that was done through a whole range of methods. One of the things that came up in the Board of Assessors, for example, was that as a committee, we had to decide on those students who were at risk. This at-risk terminology entered the arena.
What does at risk mean? At risk of what?
Of failing. Any students who were sort of like, you know, just borderline, just passing, at risk of failing, they were the students who were then targeted for special sort of remedial work, and they'd be referred to learning support. And academic staff would be conscious of these people and actually give them more and more attention.
It seems that the current system you're talking about is a situation where you have academics who are being overworked. They're being asked to teach subjects that sometimes that they're only being acquainted with several weeks before the course begins. They're under pressure to pass students that might be mediocre or worse than mediocre. Why haven't academics acted up more? Why did they just accept this change?
I don't know if they have accepted it.
What's happened, hasn't it?
Yes. One of the reasons I wrote the book is because a lot of academics, you know, would complain about the system, whether it was the pressure to pass students, whether it was, you know, being too busy, whether it was being overwhelmed, whether it was the changing nature of expectations of academic work. But they would complain often in private. But the nature of these complaints were very heartfelt, and there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of tremendous amount of stress amongst many academics, and many of them were very tired. Many of them were suffering mental health problems. And many of them felt very constrained by the system. They felt they couldn't speak out. And the reason for that was because they felt there would be some kind of retributive sort of action on the part of their line managers. So if they
Do you
spoke
think that's out, right?
Well, I think that the process of review currently that exists in universities certainly makes academics very conscious about their performance as a whole.
And will there be blowback for you now that you've blown the whistle on this?
Well, not really, because I'm no longer in full-time academic work. In that sense, I'm in an honorary position. So I'm in a very privileged position where I can actually speak out. In this competitive market model in which universities find themselves, they're essentially protecting a brand. And this brand means everything. It means that the better, the more effectively you can promote the brand, the more likely you are to get the students rolling through the doors. Now, if you actually stand up publicly and criticise universities and are seen to be somebody who's kind of rocking the boat, then there's every likelihood that you will certainly face some kind of action. There are policies in some universities which are aimed specifically at preventing academics from speaking out. Now, they won't see it as that, but what they actually put in place is that if you make any public comment about the university or about higher education more generally, that that comment has to be approved through the university channels.
Wow. I mean, what about the principle of academic freedom? I mean, that just seems to completely contradict that. The whole point of academic tenure is that academics can speak truth to power, isn't it? That they can speak the truth as they see it. Why isn't that fought hard against? I don't understand how that can be just swept under the overpowers of the media department of the university.
I don't think freedom exists in universities in that sense. You know, sure, academics can speak out. They are constrained for the reasons I've just outlined.
So this is what you're alleging is extremely serious, really.
Yes, look, what I'm doing is reflecting many of the views which are put to me by academics themselves about why don't they speak out. The other factor is, which is really concerning, and I find this incredible, actually, really, that given this environment in which academics work, that you'd think that they'd have a very, you know, that all of them would be charging towards the union and seeking their protection and, you know, fighting for the decasualization of the labor force, you know, encouraging greater freedom, greater autonomy. But what we actually see is actually that it's a minority of academics that actually belong to the union.
It's been great to speak with you, Richard, and enlightening and kind of alarming at the same time. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.